Welcome to 96.3's live 2.5 hour show, Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, the November 11th, 2000 edition, with special guest star Flower, who's going to be giving us the update from San Jose and give us some details on uncomfortable processes for homeless activists who try to get involved. Trial tomorrow in San Jose for your talk show host here, Robert Norris. Happy John Dine Memorial today at the Del Mar Theater, and then at Happy Corner a block away, starting at 4, and real festivities commencing at 6. Stay with us. Lots of information coming at you, plus Scott Graham from his hospital bed. November nights with a pretty frosty winter already on top of us. I'm your host, Robert Norris, and this is 2.5 hours of civil rights on the streets on Free Radio Santa Cruz here at 96.3 FM. If you want to get in touch with us during the show, we have live on-air phone line at 427-3772, as well as a voicemail if you want to give us a message off the air, us being the free radio station, at 427-4523. If you're particularly interested in the topic of the topics that we cover on this show, civil rights for the poor, give a call to HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, if there's something you want to talk about off air, or if you need information that you don't think you want to ask about on air. And the number there is easy enough, 423-HUF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Again, the on-air number, if you want to join this discussion, and that, of course, is what I would prefer, because we need to hear from you out there, and we really would like to have you in the studio if the studio were big enough and if we were sufficiently well-organized. And since we can't, we are using the phone lines to get as many people as we can involved in the subjects we're talking about. So again, 427-3772 is the number to call for the next 2.5 hours until 1:30, and indeed after that, when you talk to subsequent shows that will be going on round the clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. That's what we do here. We're round the clock, non-commercial, non-vanilla, out with the issues in the community, and hopefully we get the community in the station through the phone lines. So do give us a call. We have a lot of stuff happening in terms of this particular show. We have, as I say, we have a guest with us I'm going to introduce in just a moment. First, I'm going to kind of run through what's going to be happening on the show today for those of you who want to get a sense of when to tune in and when to go grab a sandwich or take a breather, since this is such a long show. The first hour of the show today, from 11 to 12, we're going to be talking with Flower, who's been an activist in Santa Cruz, Berkeley, San Jose, and the up and down the coast for the last decade, perhaps more. She's going to give us some updates from different areas, as well as give a very personal account of what's been happening to her lately and its significance in terms of how a person who has been homeless, looks homeless, or has an agenda to reestablish civil rights for homeless people is treated and mistreated in different places. We have the City Council agenda coming up around noon. We're going to contact Scott Graham, Scope It Out Scott, our City Council activist who is currently in Dominican Hospital recovering from a knee operation. He's okay. They're checking minor infection in his knee, and they're trying to see how it's going, so he's staying in there a little longer than he'd expected. But he will be joining us around noon, so if you want to tune in at that time, we're going to be getting his very informative, up-to-the-date, up-to-the-minute report on the upcoming City Council meeting, which will be on Tuesday this week, and running over the agenda for those of you who like the masochistic pursuit of trying to get the City Council to do what it should be doing. In the next hour between 12 and 1, we're hoping to get an update from producer Becky Johnson. She produces this show as well as her own Club Cruise show on the 1996 elections. And it's not just in other cities and in Florida where election processes are dubious. Becky has some concerns about what happened in Santa Cruz in 1996. We're going to be hopefully talking with activist Nancy Nichols, and that'll be probably between 12 and 1 as well. Nancy Nichols is with the Community Homeless Alliance Ministry, which has been mounting protests in San Jose to provide more shelter space for the vast number of homeless people in that, the second largest city in California. And she went to trial recently. We heard a brief update on that. She and five others were found guilty of disrupting a council meeting. I will be facing the same charges tomorrow morning in San Jose court, and we're going to be talking about that and about what's happening in San Jose from her between 12 and 1. We're also going to be looking into the criminalization of the homeless survey, which is a survey that is being put out by the Coalition on Homelessness and actually a broader national coalition of which the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness is a part. I've actually recorded a long interview that I and Becky Johnson had with the questioner from San Francisco, and we're going to be playing that on a subsequent show. We may give you a little taste of that on today's show. I want to point out an all-day demo is happening at the town clock. At least this is what I hear from the grapevine on the voting, that is to say, to demand a recount or a revote in Florida. And we're going to be discussing that. I'm also going to be reading you some updates from the internet and from the newspaper, so I've got a day crammed full of stuff. Before we jump right into it, which we will shortly, we're going to finish up an interview with Linda LeMaster on the issue of fingerprinting welfare recipients, fingerprinting TANF recipients. And we were talking about that at the end of last show, didn't have time to conclude the tape. Now we're going to play that, and then we're going to go directly into a discussion with Flower. So stay with us on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Food stamps are issued based on what your income is, but if you're in this sort of realm between what they legally call very low income and low income, any change you make, any other new money you might get, say I did some child care or dog sitting and I got a little money and I reported it, then they reduce my food stamps. It's not exactly dollar for dollar, but it's essentially or generally you lose in food spending dollars whatever you made in real dollars.
Right, so it's either tampons or food stamps.
Yeah, the food pantry that we built when I was with We Listen, our welfare parent support group, it tries real hard to work around the limitations that we know are in what the food stamp system allows to be paid for. But what I learned at this panel, Robert, that I found most fascinating is that they anticipate, as far as people who are eligible for food stamps, that means they're hungry already. They expect that there's about 300 cases altogether of food stamp-related welfare fraud in the state of California.
Out of how many cases generally? Are we talking tens of thousands of people who receive food stamps? Is this, in other words, it's less than 0.1% or something?
Yeah, it's less than 1%. It's obscene. It's just.
And of course, the whole rationale for this fingerprinting is not because they want to do artistic depictions of people's fingerprints, but because they want to put you in a criminal roster with the intent of intimidating or preventing misuse of the food stamps.
Yeah, it was interesting that Donna Blitzer was saying that these impediments they create to make you not feel good about getting stamps are contradictory to the intent of Congress in creating the food stamps.
Can you explain that?
Well, it's like Congress passed this thing that originally was to subsidize farm excess. It wasn't really meant to help hungry people. That was a sort of a sideline.
How long did this forum last?
I guess it was about an hour and a half.
And was it well attended?
I thought it was a good attendance, but a number of the Wilf ladies were just sad because I guess they usually have about three times as many people. There were at least 25 people in the audience and six of us up front.
I think it happened on a busy evening. You had 50 or 60 or 70 people at the SCAN general membership meeting over at the Police Station Community Center, which they rented for only $100 or something like that, I understand, a ridiculous amount of money. It's $100 to the police station, but nothing for the SCAN Beach Flats Dolphin Forum. Interesting priorities. But I'm going to be talking about that under another rubric. Was there much audience participation? Did you learn anything strikingly new at this forum? Sorry for the two different questions.
Yeah. The four of us made presentations, and then there was a lot of audience interaction and some good questions. And I did. It kind of brought me back up to speed with the food stamp law by hearing from Willie from the food bank. He's the one that said that 300 cases in this whole state of California, the most populous state, that's who they hope to find with all this investment of $60 million.
Are there mainly food stamp recipients in the audience, or are they mainly social service providers who are hired by the, have a job with the local government?
It looked to me like the audience was mostly women my age or older. I knew about a third of them from years in Santa Cruz, and so of the ones I knew, a couple of them would be food stamp recipients. But most of them probably are retired and they have some sort of pension if they're lucky. Paul Johnson from the ACLU was in the audience, and a few other people. I can only wonder. I don't know what their needs are. But Wilf historically has looked for ways to stick up for poor people and try to make more justice out of these systems.
Now, I know that I spoke to someone the other day who's concerned that he doesn't want to be fingerprinted. He lives in a household where his mother gets food stamps. He's no longer a minor, but he lives there, and they say they will deny his mother food stamps unless he himself gets fingerprinted. So this fingerprinting doesn't even simply go to people who actually are receiving food stamps, but just people who are in the same household as those receiving?
Right. Like, it's exactly in my house. The food stamps are for my son. I'm told by the state that he's his own separate household because I'm crippled, so I don't count as the same household as him. But I'm the one that has to go get my fingerprint over to them if he's going to get his stamps. What I heard...
You're the adult in that situation, though, right?
Right. And in the real world, the rest of the legal world, I'm responsible for him.
But in this situation that I was telling you, we're talking about one adult whose mother... I guess is getting food stamps for another minor in the household, and he's supposed to be fingerprinted even though he's not in any way involved. Are there any ways that people can resist this kind of thing, or are they just going to, will it result in criminal penalties for this household unless you go in and supinely give your fingerprint?
Well, in the situation you're describing, he needs to formally complain that he should not have to do this, and that it's kind of like an informal or what they call a fair hearing will determine whether he gets to have his position or not. But if we don't make those kind of fights and standing up to it, the family could wrongly lose their food stamps. What I learned listening last night at the panel was that it's only the head of household that they can ask that of legally. And yet the county, as this is an example of, wants all adults fingerprinted.
How can people get more information so they can actually, get the laws involved, maybe get more specific information, or maybe read some material on this? Any suggestions as to who they might call?
Yeah, if you're interested in the regulations, there's a group that can help you. You also have the right to go to the welfare department and ask them to show you the regulations. If they have normal hours.
The welfare department in the phone book under the county, Emmeline Street? How is it described in the phone book?
You look up Human Resources Agency under the county, and then somewhere under there it'll say food stamps. You can't get a lot of information by phone, but you should be able to walk in and get someone to help you if you tell them you're looking for the actual regulations. But another group that can help you in a more friendly way, I think, is Welfare and Low Income Support Network, which is in the blue building next to the Resource Center for Nonviolence.
509 Broadway?
Yeah, and that's near Ocean Street. And they have copies of the regulations, and they should have some of the other resources from different coalitions that exist around the state. Also, you could call...
Phone number 458...
458-9070.
I remember it now that you've said it. 458-9070 for...
We listen, Welfare and Low Income Support Network, and there's someone in the office for drop-in supposedly on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoons, but you can call and arrange for other times that more suit your family, too. Also, if you call the food bank and ask for Willie, he's the executive director there, you could get the some computer links for the different coalitions around the state, and there's a national one, too.
Probably stuff on the web, but the food bank is listed under...
Emergency Food Bank, and it's
a private organization.
It's a nonprofit.
So perhaps it'll be under just ordinary yellow white pages.
Yeah, it would be listed with businesses if you have the segregated phone book.
And if people are have other questions about resources, please refer them to Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423 Huff. And then, Linda, perhaps at a time of your convenience, I'll try to get back to you and ask you those questions. I give out your number, but I think you're probably a bit overburdened at the moment.
No, I would like to hear from people. I'm going to try to write something based on what I heard yesterday and the fact that this whole Food Stamp Act is going to have to be re-enacted within the year. So I want to write something, and I already have some samples of letters that people who might want to write to the state legislature could use as models. And I also would love to hear from people who have gone through the fingerprinting, how they felt about it. So my number, although sometimes it takes a day or two to get back to everyone, my number is 423-4663, 423-HOME.
And 423-HOME.
And Robert, I'll make available to you this briefing paper that I'm trying to put together, and maybe there's a way to you and I can find to make it available to the public.
Now, is there any way that citizens at a local level, either through their city council or through the Board of Supervisors, could have some conceivable impact on this policy? I mean, could the Board of Supervisors issue a statement opting out of the fingerprinting? Are there any kind of voluntary local options or anything about that?
I don't think the county can. Certainly politically, they won't opt out. They should take a stand against it, but it wouldn't save our county from doing it. But
has Supervisor Wormhout taken a stand?
No, I don't think she even knows about
any of the other supervisors.
Not to my knowledge. But they need to be informed about it, and we need their help lobbying the state. Fred Keeley will help with this, I'm told. I learned that last night, that he finds it totally out of line that people should be fingerprinted when the issue is hunger. So we need to take advantage of that and lobby more than Fred Keeley.
Fred Keeley is, of course, he's the representative, or he's the state senator?
The state senator.
The representative, I think it's Representative Keeley and State Senator McPherson, I think is what it is. That's they were all showing.
You're right.
They were all weighing in at the SCAN meeting last night. Hmm. You wanted to say some other things, perhaps.
What? I don't know what else.
No, perhaps not. I don't know.
Interview with Linda LeMaster of the Housing Now in California, who she was also a longtime worker with We Listen, previously called the Welfare parent support group for those of you who are concerned about civil liberties being eroded away in the middle, in the center, and on the edges by forcing people on getting food stamps not only to fingerprint themselves but also have others in the same household fingerprint themselves, even those who aren't receiving food stamps. A strange kind of expansion of police powers. And if you want more information about that, you can give a call to 423-HOME, 423-4663, and talk to Linda LeMaster yourself. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Robert Norse, and our call-in number is 427-3772. In the studio with us is Flower Hopkins, activist in Santa Cruz for many a moon. Welcome, Flower. And you're busy writing away on your new copy of The Street Spirit, and you can tell the new one, folks, because it has a yellow cover. It's the November issue, and it's another one of the best of issues of The Street Spirit. You can get this from your friendly Street Spirit vendor. He gets all the profit. We don't take any of it. It's a dollar or however much you want to give away. If you want to be a vendor for Street Spirit, if you're either homeless or near homelessness, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Check out the Homeless Services Center. We haven't gotten the stacks to them yet, but we will. And the Page Smith Community House, another place where we give out a bundle of these Street Spirits. Hopefully they are distributing them to homeless people to sell, because that's the point, so that on these freezing cold nights you can actually make a couple of bucks, go get a cup of coffee, and save yourself from freezing for an hour or two. Flower, welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz and Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides.
Hi. And I just want to say I'm not much of an activist. A tiny bit of an activist.
Well, it sounds like you're certainly a person who's very well read. I see you were making a lot of notes on this story in The Street Spirit on the ICORN decision, which I guess you wanted raised today and talk about, and I want to hear about that too. That's the decision that says if a man in Santa Ana who had shelter, who had no shelter and yet was nonetheless criminalized under one of their sleeping bans down there, I think it was also a sleeping ban or a camping ban, and it reached the California State Supreme Court, and they ruled that, you know, you had to allow the man to use the necessity defense. That is the defense that even if what he was doing was illegal by the letter of the law, still, and even if the law was constitutional in some cases, he could show that as a homeless person, if he had no other options, then the law could not be applied to him because there was a greater necessity that he had to follow than the law and a greater evil to be averted. And we're going to talk about that later. But Flower, you called me this morning at the crack of dawn with some rather disturbing news talking about a church over in San Jose, the First Christian Church.
Right.
This is a church I know that has done some good things, although it's been timid at times as well. It's housed homeless people over the objections of the city of San Jose, and then I think it kind of acceded to those objections for a while. It's been the church where Scott Wagers and Nancy Nichols of the Community Homeless Alliance Ministry, activists who have been high profile, and I mentioned that they went to jail, or that they were arrested at least, and hauled off for a bit and cited for trying to raise the issue before San Jose Mayor Gonzalez about failure to deal with the homeless crisis there while engaging in huge giveaways to corporations in San Jose. But this church apparently gave you, at least two people there who were with the church gave you some trouble yesterday. What happened?
That's true. I went to an Abolition 2000 meeting there that was about banning nuclear weapons. And following that meeting was one about an action to take place on Armed Force Day in May at the Vandenberg base in Santa Barbara.
Is that a nuclear disarmament sort of thing? Or?
I'm not sure of the name, because I guess I came into the meeting, and just when I was starting to tune into it, then two people came to the door and told me that I had to leave the meeting, and you know that's what this is all about.
Now, this was a closed meeting that said on it, no homeless people allowed, although you're not really homeless. You do live in Watsonville, as I understand it.
But right.
You had a little kind of not a shopping cart, but what do you call it, a carry-all cart with you that you kind of wheel around.
That I left outside the church, and I guess my appearance looks homeless. Plus, the Tri-Valley Care is an anti-nuclear group newsletter. It did not advertise that meeting as a closed meeting. And to make sure, I asked the leader of the meeting, Peter, who works at the Santa Cruz Resource
Center.
Peter
Lumsdaine?
I don't know his last name yet. For nonviolence, you know, if it was all right for me to come to the meeting. And he said yes. A lot of the people from the first meeting, the Abolition 2000 meeting, came to the second meeting and introduced themselves. In fact, there were more people from other groups than from the Vandenberg group itself. And another woman who came independently, and she wasn't asked to leave.
So you were the only person you know of that was asked to leave this
meeting? The only person. And then I was told that I was part of the San Jose community. I mean, the word homeless was left out, but, you know, it was inferred. And I was told that I might sneak sleeping in the church that night, and that's why I had to leave.
And who told you this?
Judith Wright.
A woman who, I think actually she was even arrested with us at this Community Homeless Alliance Ministry protest, and I'm indeed going to try to reach her. We've already kind of filed a complaint by phone about this, and I guess you've written some letters.
Yeah, I did write some letters, and I made some phone calls to Scott Wages, who has a ministry at the church, and wrote a letter to the pastor of the church, and might phone him tomorrow to tell him about what happened.
Now, this was particularly disadvantageous for you because you told me you spent 4 hours by Amtrak and then by foot getting to this.
Actually, well, four buses, and 1 hour on foot. You know, just coming from Watsonville to Santa Cruz to San Jose, and then walking from the Caltrain station where the Amtrak bus stops to the First Christian Church on Fifth Street. Took me about half an hour each way. And actually, I had the Santa Cruz bus schedule, metro schedule, in my hand when I was approached, which I pointed out to Judith because the Amtrak bus schedule is on there. I was just scanning it for the next two buses to leave. I wasn't planning to stay for the whole meeting.
And this was to convince her that you weren't one of those homeless types who was going to, God forbid, sleep in the back of the church?
Right, and that, you know, is also a major point. What, even if I was homeless, I might not have had that in mind, it should be open to people to, you know, sleep in.
When I
and travelers as well as the city people.
I agree. I'm giving you not the other side, but perhaps another side that I heard when I spoke with activist Nancy Nichols, who for a long time was Scott Wager's partner, now is doing her own thing here in Santa Cruz, but was also one of those arrested in the group of 23 last February when we were in front of the city council. And she actually was found guilty in the first trial, and I'll be going tomorrow on this. She told me that the First Christian Church, although it has agreed sort of informally to begin putting up homeless people again in its confines, as it has for the last couple of years on and off, depending on the pressure of the city and the also the determination of the, I guess, the minister or the pastor who's in power and how the board of directors feels about it, and what other alternatives are available. Though usually there are no alternatives available, but there are some sort of pseudo-alternatives that are presented, like, you know, tonight we can put you all up in a motel, but what about the next night? You know, they don't get into that. That the First Christian Church has been having problems with the city. They are now, once again, planning to reopen. The problems with the city are the city doesn't want them to reopen as a homeless shelter or as a de facto homeless shelter. So Nancy suggested that she was very surprised to hear this had happened to you. She's really going to look into it, and she's concerned about it. You might ask, why am I bringing this up before some sort of back room or backdoor process or quiet diplomacy process happens? My answer to that is, though I actually like the people who are part of this protest. And I guess Judith Wright was one of them, and I don't know. If what you tell us, it sounded like she screwed up here. I think that when such a thing happens, as happened to you, which has a serious impact on you. I mean, if you were a person with a significant amount of money, theoretically you could sue for, you know, being denied access to a meeting, you know, for all the suffering that you had to do in terms of the transportation costs. But of course, you know, you don't have the resources to do any such thing, and they probably don't have the resources to pay you, even if you did sue. But I mean, it's just bad, and I think it's important, you know, to talk about these things publicly. Judith, I've not been able to get her phone number yet, but we're going to try to get her perspective on this, and hopefully it's all going to be worked out. But it really is a particularly burdensome situation for a person who is who doesn't have their own vehicle, who doesn't have their own means of transportation, who you have been homeless at different points, right, Flower?
Right. And sometimes I travel, and I, you know, sleep out wherever I wind up, but I've avoided doing that in San Jose because it seems like a dangerous place to me. And I was given permission to sleep in the First Christian Church at two points within the last 3 years, once when I was on my way to Stanford to have an operation sort of as a rest stop, and one other time when Scott Wages got permission from the board for me to sleep there for a night or two.
We actually may be hearing, maybe calling Nancy Nichols shortly. In fact, I think we may want to do that soon so we can actually get her on the line and you can kind of have a dialogue with her. And although, again, she's not the power here. She's just an individual who's trying to, who knows the people involved but has no real authority. You were also interested, before we leave that subject, is there more specifically you want to tell us about what happened?
Well, what really upsets me is that I feel I was appearance profiled. You know, I was profiled because I look like a homeless person. I have this cart. I lug around food when I'm out all day, so I don't have to eat at restaurants. I couldn't afford that. I just live off an SSI check. And some, you know, extra clothes for when it gets cold at night, rain boots, a rain jacket in case it starts raining, and some books and literature, writing paper. So, because I've had some operations that I can't carry it in a backpack on my back, I can't carry it in my arms, I use this cart. And it just seems to me that I was labeled homeless because of how I look, and because I have the cart, which was jumping to a conclusion, and then lied to and told I was part of the San Jose community, which I'm not, and even when I stated the truth, I wasn't listened to, and so this seems completely unjust. And, you know, just singled out of a meeting because of my appearance, you know, thinking that I was going to commit what in the eyes of the city would be a criminal act of sleeping in the church.
And of course, it wouldn't be a criminal act because it might be a voluntary agreement with the church. They didn't have any understanding that you, A, were going to sleep there, or B, that you didn't have permission to be there. And anyway, you were there for a meeting. The whole thing sounds pretty strange to me, and I'm hoping to get some more information. But why don't we use this as a basis for asking people who are out there and listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz now to ask you the question, have you suffered this kind of appearance profile before? Have you had a police officer or an authority figure stop you and say, you know, because of your looks, or perhaps unspoken, but it seemed clear to you that it was because of your looks, you weren't allowed to have the same right to use public spaces or private spaces to which you were entitled because of the fact that they were open to the public or the fact that you'd paid to be there? Have you ever had that kind of discrimination happen to you? Give us a call at 427-3772, 427-FRSC for Free Radio Santa Cruz, of course, 427-3772, and join Flower Hopkins and myself here on the radio and let us know if this has ever happened to you. I know I have seen it happen to a homeless person recently at the, well, recently, 4 or 5 months ago, not that recently, but a particular instance comes to mind because it has to do with an organization that our tax dollars help pay for, the Convention Center, the Chamber of Commerce Convention Center, which is on Ocean Street. As you come in, it's near a Baker Square cafe or restaurant, and they were having a grand opening, and I happened by with the son, the teenage son of one of a previously homeless woman, in this community. We went it had signs outside, grand opening. There was food out there, and we tried to go in, and you know, it seemed to be open to the public. There was no indication that it wasn't, and we were told, "Oh, you can't go in there. It's not open to the public." But the impression as we watched later, it seemed that other people were going in there, and it seemed that they weren't by invitation only, and it was because of the appearance of the situation. I spoke about that at City Council and suggested that the Chamber of Commerce was engaging in a form of discrimination with respect to this particular grand opening. And again, one can always be wrong. You know, one can always, there might have been some confusion or lack of communication, as might have happened in your case, Flower. It could be that they mistook you for a notorious female child killer who's been roaming San Jose. It looks just like you. Or maybe they were told, you know, don't allow anybody with a shopping cart within 30 feet until we talk to a Reverend Wagers or whoever. Actually, he isn't. Scott Wagers doesn't run the First Christian Church. It's somebody else. He's allowed to use their premises, and he's the activist who has a ministry. But, I mean, it could be something else. But I think that it's not unfair to raise the question, you know, what's going on here? So I think that's what we're doing here.
Right. Yeah. I agree. It could have been something that I don't know about having been a factor. But also, Judith Wright's purse had disappeared while I was outside speaking to an elderly homeless woman who claimed she resides on the church grounds because she's a widow, and widows had the right to reside on church grounds. So, and I had asked her about the shelters in San Jose, a subject I'm always interested in, the shelters in various places, you know, in case I ever need to or want to use them. And Judith might have overheard that conversation and, you know, jumped to the conclusion I was seeking shelter that night, or because of my appearing homeless, thought that I looked like the type of person to have stolen her purse.
Well, it seems strange, though, that she would bar you from a... How late did this happen? What time of day?
This was around 5:45 or 5 when they came in to the meeting room door and you know, called me to the door and told me...
So you were
me,
in the meeting, yeah, and you were called out of the meeting,
I was called out of the meeting, right.
I see. So there was they felt you were somehow some sort of riffraff that had drifted. This was the impression you got.
That's what I see. Like, maybe they thought I was there just to stay warm. I also need to use the bathroom a lot. I have irritable bowel syndrome, and maybe that seemed like a suspicious activity to them, you know, walking in and out of the meeting to use the bathroom. And I also went out occasionally to speak to this elderly homeless woman, just to give her some companionship. There was a lot of food at the first meeting, so I brought her a little food and a cup of tea. You know, I have no idea of the reasoning, and you know, if they had to act maybe that way, because maybe it was a church rule, I don't know.
Did the impetus seem to come from Peter Lumsdaine or others who may have been running the meeting? I don't know if Peter was, but this Vandenberg planning session for May, or did it come from the church folks? Did you get any...
No, I don't think it was from Peter or anyone in the meeting, because first I spoke to a woman. I asked her, is this an open meeting? And she said yes. But she said, you know, to make sure, ask Peter. So I went and asked Peter, and he said, sure, you can stay. And in fact, later I volunteered to do some phone work that... it's all the working people and students who were attending the meeting don't have time to do. And he really appreciated that. When I was asked to go outside, he actually followed me outside and wanted to know when, you know, I can contact him about that.
Was he informed that you were being evicted from the meeting?
You know, I just didn't want to get into it with him. I knew it was important for him to get back into the meeting. So,
I see.
Yeah.
They kind of they did the old pull you aside, kick you out, and then you don't want to make a ruckus, so you go on your way. Wow. Well, let me. Since is there more you want to say on this subject?
Well, yeah. I guess we could talk a little about the...
Right.
Icorn.
I see you're pointing at the Icorn article, and I do want to talk about that. But on this other subject.
No, I guess nothing else, you know, except that people shouldn't be judged by their appearance.
Right, and if you have had this problem and you're not wanting to talk about it on air, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and talk about it there, because we can talk to you about it quietly and privately and out of the way and see if there's anything that can be done. Although we don't do too much ourselves, we can try to advise you as to what you might want to do and maybe support you. Now, you have with you, Flower, this this Street Spirit, which has some reprints from about a year ago, actually probably less than that, on the Eichhorn decision, which again, as I said, it's a state court decision which allows homeless people faced with sleeping and camping ban tickets in different cities the option of using the necessity defense. The necessity defense usually has to be ruled on by a judge as to whether it is allowable in any case, and you have to prove a rather elaborate set of criteria for the necessity defense, which are extensive. I'm seeing if they're... Yeah, here they are. You have to show that an instruction on the defense of necessity is required where there is evidence sufficient to establish that the defendant violated the law. In other words, you admit you violated the law. You don't say, I didn't violate the law. You say, I did violate the law. I am guilty of violating the law, but I am not guilty by reason of the defense of necessity. And you have to show that six conditions adhere. One, that it was done to prevent a significant evil. It is two, that there was no adequate alternative. Three, that you weren't creating a greater danger than the one you were avoiding. Four, that you had a good faith belief that there was such a necessity. Five, that your belief was objectively reasonable. And six, that under the circumstances... that you did not substantially contribute to the emergency that created the necessity. So, for example, you didn't start a fire in the prison that allowed you to escape the prison. If a fire started in the prison and you escaped from prison, you can argue, I'm not guilty of escaping because it was a necessity. I did break the law, but I had to. But if you started the fire, obviously, that's something else. You can't use the necessity defense. So those are the necessity defense. And the judge, prior to this decision, had the option to say yes or no. It seems to be, according to the Eichhorn decision, that the judge must allow a necessity defense in cases involving camping and sleeping tickets. And so, not much of this has been made that I know of, and not much in Santa Cruz has been used around the Eichhorn decision, because it is such a complicated defense. But let me ask you your perspective on it. I know you have some thoughts that you've been kind of brewing with.
Well, I'm most interested in the aspect that... that city, like the camping laws, actually deny poor people, people who don't have any money at all, the right to travel because there is no place to sleep when one travels. And I must say that is one good aspect about the, you know, the Santa Cruz shelter system, that one can just be sheltered for one night at a time. But never places...
Let me interrupt here. Yeah, if you happen to be one of the lucky 28 people that is filling up the shelter for 8 months a year every night, usually you cannot get into the ISSP. In theory, you can, but almost invariably they will tell you it's full. And unfortunately, this is also going to be the case in the winter. So just wanted to interrupt with that.
Okay, well, I wasn't aware of that because I used that system years ago, and I guess there might have been more space then. But anyways, I did get a trespassing ticket in Berkeley, sleeping on a church porch where people had been sleeping for a good part of the week, maybe longer than that, and I was told it was all right to sleep there. There were no trespassing signs, and then on a Friday night, and there was just me and two other people. It has like a lower porch and upper porch there, and at least me and this one other person that was on the level porch that I was on got trespassing tickets with no warning. I heard first that at least just an infraction ticket is supposed to be given. So that was the scene there. And anyways, it seems there should be safe places to sleep in outside and inside, legal places, any place for people who reside in that area and for people who are traveling through. You know, the Berkeley shelter system is set up so there's a woman's shelter where someone can stay for a month and then possibly get extended time, but if one leaves, one can't come back for 3 months. So it's no good for someone who just needs a few nights' shelter.
The trespass is an interesting tool that has been used by authorities to harass homeless people. We've already talked about Robert Steffen, the man in the bag. You can talk to him yourself. He's usually outside the bookshop Santa Cruz, sits on a bench with a bag and a... He was the presidential candidate from the streets in 2000. Don't know how many votes were actually recorded for Robert Steffen. But he was, as I talked about before, three times charged with trespass for sleeping on the porch of the Homeless Services Center. And finally, he was tried and convicted of that and is now on probation for that offense. And, of course, this is in a town which, even though it has a nominal interfaith satellite shelter program, a supposed interfaith satellite shelter program, its program, as I said, only has 28 floor spaces for 28 people during 8 months of the year. And then I think it has twice as many for the winter season plus the 100 spaces at the Army. Obviously, you're going to have quite a devil of a time fitting into even 160 spaces, much less 28. So, the ICORN decision that you're looking at is one that I would like to see some attorneys volunteer to help us with. The problem with the ICORN decision for Santa Cruz sleeping ban tickets is it involves infractions. That is to say, our sleeping ban. Sleeping has been made an infraction, which means it's not a misdemeanor. And the upside of that is supposedly you don't face jail, though often if you miss a court appearance, you do face jail because a warrant goes out for you. But if you happen to make all your court appearances regularly and troop on down there, maybe miss a meal or two, miss the bus, miss this, miss that, but get down there and do your court process properly, you'll get a $54 fine or you'll get community service. And the community service question is, how much do you have to pay to get the community service done? Rumor has it you can get a waiver, but it's never been clearly outlined that you can definitely get a waiver to do community service if you're homeless without going through a certain process. And even if you do go through that process, it's not always clear you're going to get the waiver. Usually there was a $50 minimum at one point to do any kind of community service, so that's $4 less than the fine. I mean, it's hard to deal with that way. But the infraction situation with the ICORN defense is that usually with a necessity defense, what you're arguing is you're arguing in front of a jury of 12 people that I slept outside, you know, God help me, what a crime, but I had to do so because of a greater necessity. And you present all this evidence that there's no shelter space, it's freezing cold, there's a lot of violence out there, so you have to, you know, you have to find a sleep in a well-lit place with other people there, so indeed you were violating the law, but you had no choice. And if one juror believes you, that one juror can hang the jury. That is to say, the juror can say not guilty, and it needs a unanimous guilty or not guilty verdict for there to be a verdict, and then the prosecution can choose whether to try it again. The problem with the necessity defense, guaranteed by the ICORN decision before a judge, is that the judge is the same person who makes the decision about whether you're guilty or not guilty. He also makes a decision about whether the necessity defense is enough to persuade him that even if you're guilty, you're innocent by reason of necessity. What it does, it prolongs the trial somewhat, but you don't really get that kind of independent bit of evidence in there. You're relying on the same judges who are really pretty much a collusive part of the system. So, for instance, your husband, Dan Hopkins, was before Judge Kelly back in 1997 for multiple sleeping tickets for being at the City Hall Sleepers protest in 1996. He was one of the two founders, and you had scores, if not hundreds, of tickets at that protest, and he was told that it was a constitutional to go after people for sleeping at night, even when there was no other place to sleep legally, because Hopkins could have gone and slept somewhere during the day, because Dan Hopkins could have slept somewhere during the day. So you have a bunch of judges that are not particularly reasonable on this issue. In fact, they seem to be politically motivated. That is my perspective. They don't want to cause waves. They don't want to make judicial rulings that will result in new civil rights or old civil rights being restored. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, we need new rulings need shelters, need homeless camps, and people. Well, I think homeless people need to be responsible too, and you know, keep their areas clean, not defecate and urinate in inappropriate places. Of course, there should be porta potties around. But yeah, sleeping is a human right, and that should be respected.
Well, that's what Christopher Crone said 2 years ago, but then he seemed to do nothing about it. In December of 1998, he passed the resolution that sleeping was a human right. But then again, for the last two years, obviously it's also a human crime under the Santa Cruz City sleeping bans, 6.36.010A, which is the code section number for that particular municipal ordinance. And Crone's last move at City Council was to make sure that this issue didn't get on the ballot, so that nobody could, the voters had no access to saying sleeping should not be a crime. And Crone took no action over the last 4 months to make sure that sleeping was not a crime in some way, shape, or fashion. So it's interesting that the same politicians who supposedly give us sweet thoughts 1 year will give us directly opposing actions the next. There's been some suggestions, Flower, that there be protests at the first city council meeting, the first new city council meeting. This Tuesday council meeting coming up day after tomorrow will have the same old council. In fact, it'll be the last full-fledged meeting of the city council. And we're going to be talking about that with Scott Graham in a few minutes when he calls in from his hospital bed. But the second meeting in November, November 28th, could be a rallying point for people to come in great numbers and demand that there be city council action on this, or that, let's say, a tent city be set up, or that there be a continuous round-the-clock vigil. Any thoughts on that?
Sounds like a great idea. Yeah. It's, you know, would be a good time to do that. Yeah.
Hey, you're on the line with Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi. I'm just able to hear parts of your show as I'm going in and out of different rooms. But I hear you're talking of demonstrations against the new council, and I think it's really important that we not forget that it was the old council that betrayed us, and that actually all picking up of the rolling fast and picking up of the demonstrations where we left off should be directed right immediately towards the old council. And I think that the phoning of the council members Monday night and not letting them sleep, like the homeless are not allowed to sleep this Monday night before they go to city council meeting Tuesday, is very, very important, or else we're going to lose focus. It's sort of, you're suggesting starting all over again when you start with a new council, and I think we should have the continuity. The old council, the new council should know that it's the old council that betrayed us, and perhaps we could win some allies that way.
I agree.
Thank you.
I agree completely with you.
Okay, great.
Yeah. That, of course, was activist David Silva, who has been with the rest of us pressing on for a great period of time in the first 6 or 7 months of this year, as we all were, trying to get the city to set up safe sleeping zones, to put something on the ballot. He was fasting, and he was organizing others to fast. And no, I think it's a great idea that the sooner the better. People call in at 420-5017, which is the city council's 24-hour number. And that's the old city council. Actually, that's old and new. I mean, it's old right now. It'll be the same number when the new council comes in. My thought about there being a demonstration in 2 weeks, and I think there should be demonstrations before that as well, if people can organize them and get them together, is that it'll give time to prepare a protest that will essentially plunk itself down and sit there and demand that something happen. I mean, I think David is quite right. You need to have action toward the old council as well. But again, the old council won't be the council that can do something about this unless it acts on Tuesday. I guess it could conceivably act during the last hurrah it has on November 28th before it actually walks out the door, because that could be, I think that they have a little session right before they turn over the reins on November 28th. But I regard that as so unlikely that it's just sort of a form of almost symbolic protest. But I agree with him that I think any protest is definitely an improvement, and I think that it may take longer, and I think we have to really lay the responsibility where it should be on people who have had a whole 2 years to see this process. And I'm thinking of Ed Porter, I'm thinking of Scott Kennedy, I'm thinking of
Mark Premack, I'm thinking of Emily Riley. They have been at these meetings, at least Riley and Porter have, and I'm sure Kennedy knows what's going on, and Premack claims to know what's going on, although he sometimes sounds like he has no idea what's going on. Any thoughts on this election, Flower? Have you been keeping an eye on that at all?
No, I haven't, but this is like changing the subject, but this thought passed through my mind, you know, about a protest to the new city council or old city council, because I think that something else needed in Santa Cruz are more drop-in centers during the day, possibly all-night drop-in centers for people who aren't sleeping and need safe places.
Oh, definitely.
I'd like to see that brought up, too.
Yeah, the last time we had an all-night, of course, the all-night drop-in centers that currently exist are the Denny's and the Santa Cruz Diner, the all-night restaurants, and I guess maybe Jeffrey's if it's open 24 hours, I'm not sure. And the donut places, I guess Farrell's is open late, and Saturn Cafe, but those, of course, aren't funded by the city, and you got to pay something to be there, and they have security guards walking around and so forth in some of these places, and not too inviting a situation. And it also puts a burden on those places, which don't really aren't in it. They're in it for their own profit, and not as a public service to folks who have no place to be that time of night. So I agree with you. The last actual real such place that was open was a Coral Street Open Air Shelter, which was 24 hours a day. And then before that, I guess 5 years before that, there was the cafe on Front Street that Judith Beinert opened up, Las Chirales. We have a call coming in, though. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi again.
Hey, David.
Happy to go to another room to phone.
Uh-oh.
Strange. The Homeless Issues Task Force made several recommendations along these lines. You know, the Safe Haven proposal, which works in Seattle, having something open all night long that's both for people that are users and for people that are non-users is really important. Just something like a coffee shop, a soup kitchen, kind of all night long soup kitchen where somebody can get a hot bowl of soup in the middle of the night. If they're out there at 3 o'clock in the morning, they can come in out from under the rain. You know, this is the kind of thing that we need to be doing. It's nice to focus on family shelters like they try to with their negative campaign on Measure U and the negative campaign on Measure T, which flopped because of their negativity. If they had done it more positive, showing that, you know, there's some creativity and some imagination out in the community instead of being so elitist and lacking with all the creativity that is out there, they would have shown that, you know, there's a lot of things that have worked in other communities. And we are probably one of the least progressive of the communities that are actually tackling this problem head-on. Many communities have come up with solutions.
Give us some ideas. Whom that might be, David?
Well, it's Seattle, for one. They have a safe haven program for people that are drug users to be able to come out of the outer doors and not be on the street when they're stoned. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important. It's very important. It prevents crime. It prevents violence going both directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, really helpful. And sure, you have to have security for something like that. And sure, in a place where you have a safe haven for mentally ill, you have to have a nurse or something like that. And sure, in a place that's a safe haven just for single men that are out there, don't know how in the hell they got out there, you have to have some kind of social worker or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that is what we should be focusing on. You know,
David, you've been pretty close to Green Party.
And Emily Riley did say that she supported the recommendations of the Homeless Issue Task Force, so we should expect this to be implemented right away.
David, you're pretty...
Of course, she was on the Bathroom Task Force, which never got implemented.
Right, and on the Sleeping Ban, and she hadn't read the Sleeping Ban Task Force as well. But you're pretty close to Tim Fitzmaurice, who will be the new mayor, or at least presumably will be.
We'll see.
Have you raised this issue with him? I know that I've been very
critical.
I'll
be raising it this afternoon.
Good. Well, maybe you can let us know on Thursday from 6 to 8 when our show resumes, or maybe at City Council. Hopefully you'll be there to make a statement during oral communications.
I have a clinic I have to attend most Tuesday nights, so I'll try to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know that he was part of the blocking majority with Catherine Byers when Sugar and Crone tried to pass more substantive amendments to the sleeping ban.
And he was also the last one to make any kind of amendment at all to try to get something done, and he was blocked by Christopher Crone.
Well, so he blocked himself. He voted for that. He voted for tabling it himself, if you may remember.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, he was the last one to try to do something substantive that was at least for the people that don't have vehicles.
You and I can disagree on this one.
I give him credit for that, you know, and if you don't want to give him credit for that, fine.
Right.
I give him credit for tabling it so that nothing could be done with it. That was his final vote. And had he voted the other way, it would have been discussed.
I think it was one of those things that they had gone until, 1:07 in the morning?
No, that was an earlier session.
They threw their hands in the air.
No, that was an earlier.
It was a throw their hands in the air vote. I thought it was pretty stupid. But then let's face it, this was a cowardly bunch that knuckled under to an evil queen, you know.
Right, so what are you doing to buck up the courage of this Fitzmaurice man on the Green Party? That's what we're all wondering.
Yeah, well, we're in good communication with him, let's put it that way.
Because I think you should withdraw.
It's better than being in bad communication with him, Robert.
I think you should communicate that if he doesn't shape up, he gets censured and ousted, or you repudiate him.
The Green Party is not a censure, ouster, faction, purge kind of organization. We are a consensus-building organization. We're going to continue to build consensus, no matter how many people out there think they can come over and take over and do factions and split us
it's
up.
It's not factions to tell
work.
A politician who is selling out people on this
right.
issue that you're not going to support the sellout.
We
That's
don't
all.
Do this kind of divisiveness.
It's
That's
not
what the Green Party does. That's not what the Green Party does, Robert.
Right, I don't think it's...
I know you're used to Peace and Freedom Party ways,
and all the
destructiveness that the Peace and Freedom Party went through,
David,
but we're not going to go through that with the Green Party.
David, if the Green Party is endorsing...
If the Green Party is endorsing Tim Fitzmaurice, who is a man who is, in essence, killing sleeping ban reform, as he has been, and I have to really disagree with David on this issue, even though he hangs up on me, and David, you're welcome to call back again at some point, although I think we probably have a real difference of opinion on this, and you know, let's accept that fact. Fitzmaurice was part of the majority that killed any sleeping ban reform. He killed it first by refusing to demand documentation when the bogus charges were laid that killed the safe sleeping zones, about there being trash and litter and so forth and complaints in the safe sleeping zones. And he finally killed it on July 25th when the issue came up for a sleeping ban amendment on the ballot. He did propose a completely preposterous amendment, which had all kinds of problems to it. It declared it actually made it worse for people in vehicles. It was a crazy amendment, which was essentially a response to the city's apprehension, some politician's apprehension that we can't let people sleep in their vehicles anywhere on public property because a few private pressuring groups from business communities came up with their unsubstantiated fears and undocumented fears. And he ran on this issue like a rabbit with everybody else. And I think if the Green Party is going to be endorsing him, and David is a member of the Green Party, so he's sensitive about this, it has to be real clear. It has to censure him. Not because he's a member of the Green Party, and I agree with him completely. You can have whatever opinions you want on the Green Party. But if he is an elected representative, and he's touting his Green Party credentials, he can't be doing that. Or the Green Party lacks all credibility. That's how I feel about it. But, you know, let's not get factional. Let's agree to disagree. I have an incoming call, and I will want to have a dialogue with this next caller rather than a monologue. So if this is you, David, let's have a dialogue. Hello.
Hello, Robert.
Uh-oh, it's not David Silva. It's Scott Graham. We just had a bit of a discussion on air. I should say David made a statement and hung up on me, supporting Tim Fitzmaurice and how Tim really did a lot of good things around the sleeping ban. He was the last person to try hard and so forth.
Tim didn't do a damn thing.
Well, that's my view, too.
He actually wrote something that no one would support.
Right.
Intentionally. It wasn't like he did that by accident.
Well, that I don't know.
He intentionally did that.
But I know what he did do intentionally was he refused to allow any discussion on it at City Council because when Christopher Crone moved to table it, his one vote could have forced there to be discussion.
Right.
And he refused to do that. And for his advocates, because they like him in power, they have personal feelings for him, to support that kind of position is, to me, to be blind to the facts on that issue.
Right.
But we have in the studio with us, Scott, and I know you haven't been able to listen to the show because you're out there at Dominican, and they just are not giving you the Free Radio Santa Cruz access you need.
Right. For some reason, it doesn't come in out here.
Well, I think it's shocking, you know. You are... sort of the man who keeps a close watch on the city council. And I have I guess we talked a bit earlier about the city council agenda, and I would like to run through some of what I think are the significant points on the agenda and get your thoughts on the agenda. And I'm thumbing through my notes now to make sure yes, here we are.
I'm sure you're not rifling the files.
Ah, yes, rifling the files, yes. Another story entirely. That, of course, you're referring to the SCAN's reason for, SCAN Steering Committee's reason for, actually, SCAN Steering Coordinator's reason for barring me from the SCAN headquarters.
Right.
in a, oh boy, that's a whole other ball of wax, but it again shows a kind of bad process that seems to be promulgating all over the city.
Well, I mean, you have the same group of people running things, you know, it doesn't matter what you're talking about, and they don't like any sort of, like, you know, outside intrusion into what they're doing. They like to pretend they're allowing people to be part of their little clique, but when things really come down to the nitty-gritty, they don't want to give up one ounce of control.
Yeah, I'm afraid that there is that. Definitely got that feeling in dealing with the SCAN steering committee, which has been notoriously undemocratic.
I mean, the SCAN steering committee is basically just a front for Nora and Bernice. I mean, Nora and Bernice run SCAN, and the steering committee is just a rubber stamp to say that there is a public process.
I don't know if I would be that severe, but I certainly found, based upon, I know that the steering committee initially was supportive of the Dolphin Lee tenants, the tenants out in the Beach Flats area who are now pretty much in the hands of Mercy Charities, which I'm afraid is going to start thinning them out and sending them on the road. And for several votes, at least when I showed up at the steering committee meetings, resolutions by Nora Hockman and Bernice Belton to essentially kiss off the Dolphin Lee Forum, which was the SCAN-mandated forum to look at what was really going on out there and make sure that guarantees were in place for the tenants before proceeding further. And that, of course, has been ignored by the city council, which has been rolling right ahead with the Dolphin Lee project. Right now, the Dolphin project without the Lee, but who knows? So, yeah, I don't know, because I know that when I was not present at the steering committee meeting, when they held it in a private home, they dissolved the housing committee without having any members of the housing committee there to discuss what they were doing, and this was on resolution of Nora Hockman. They disaffiliated themselves from the Dolphin Lee Forum, and I guess they approved, but though not necessarily through formal vote, Tom Shaver's decision to bar me from SCAN headquarters for allegedly rifling the files.
Right.
When in fact I was looking at two binders that were open to members of the public, in which sense Tom Shaver has let me take, and I've been examining on police review and on the old beach area plan. But let's get back to the city council agenda, which I have here. Anybody can get it, by the way, on the internet. It is available. You got to go to the
www.
Do you know that? You don't know the site offhand?
No, George Bush was saying that, you know, Al Gore invented the internet, but how come everything starts with www?
That's a good point. Yes, that's a significant. Well, moving right along here, Scott. There's a this is on Tuesday, November 14th, is the next city council session. And by the way, you won't find that in the Sentinel. Of all the information that there are various meetings, must be at least two dozen meetings arrayed for the next week in the Santa Cruz Sunday Sentinel. But the city council meeting, perhaps the most important meeting of all, is not mentioned. It is amazing. So 1:30 is the closed litigation session. 3:00 is the afternoon session of City Council, and there are a couple items on it that I wanted to bring to your attention, ask for your thoughts on. We have the adoption of a memorandum of understanding with the supervisory employees and approving revision to the compensation plan, item 3. And you expressed some concern, although you haven't got access to the documents, that this might involve more bucks for the people at the top.
Yeah, I think it's probably has something to do with, you know, increasing their pension benefits and also their various, you know, perks of having the job in the first place. You know, like probably they're going to get an increase in their travel allowances per month and increase in their their medical insurance coverage and all these kind of things.
Then items 5 and 7 have to do with acquiring vehicles. One is from the Municipal Finance Corporation, 6 vehicles, that's item 5. Item 7 is a sole source purchase of a fire command vehicle for $62,000, including tax from a out-of-the-county firm in Yorba Linda, California. What do you think of that?
Well, once again, I don't have any documents in front of me, so I don't really know what's going on there. I mean, some specialized equipment like that, there may only be one company in the state that actually has that stuff for sale.
Mm-hmm. So it may not be some special deal.
Right, it may not be one of these, you know, backroom deals where, you know, there's a possibility of like getting kickbacks and all this kind of stuff. Right?
But still worth looking at wherever you see the word sole source purchase.
Right, yeah, anytime there's a sole source purchase or a sole source provider.
Such as Mercy Charities
right.
Housing with
you
the Dolphin Loan.
Question, line. You know, why is there a sole source? Why isn't this going out to most, you know, see who comes in with the lowest bid type deal?
Mm-hmm. Then these are items 3, 5, 7, and item 15, and this again is all on the consent agenda. What you do in the consent agenda is you put in a little green card and say, please take this item off the consent agenda, and so then you can talk about it for 3 minutes or so to the community and to the council, and it's on a televised kind of situation, so you can actually speak to the community. Item 15 is the notice of completion of the Santa Cruz Police Facility, a resolution accepting the work done, which, of course, I think it's, what, a $6 or $7 million cost overrun?
Yeah, I believe so. It could even be more with their, you know, since people started questioning the cost of this building, they somehow decided that, oh, no, the overruns aren't that bad anymore. And they're trying to, I mean, I think you yourself tried to question the cost overruns, and they basically tried to show you that they were still under cost on this thing.
Well, for folks who are interested in talking about the police department, this is one way you can kind of segue into it by talking about the police facility. You can also talk about the huge amounts of money that have been spent on the police facility compared to the complete lack of money on meaningful homeless campgrounds or
drug treatment facilities.
Such as David Silva was quite properly talking about earlier. He was talking about a drug treatment, but about a 24-hour or a drop-in center at night, which, you know, is quite appropriate to have. Then there's item 18 is an amendment to a cooperative agreement between Santa Cruz, the redevelopment agency, relating to park fees for the Sycamore Street Cooperative Housing Project to extend time for performance. You want to tell us a little bit about that? That's also on the redevelopment agenda, which starts at 5 o'clock, so it's an item that appears on both agendas. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, this is, you know, there's a requirement whenever there's large housing projects built, whether it's a, you know, like Sycamore is a government project, but even when there's a private project done, that there's a requirement that there has to be so much park space available for the people that are going to be living there. And in the beach south of Laurel area where Sycamore Commons is, there's a park deficit at the moment. And the same thing exists over off of Laurel Street where Maynard Manson is going to be building his 100-plus unit apartment complex. And Maynard Manson got relief from that. He didn't have to pay into this park deficit fee. And I believe Sycamore Commons also got relief from it, but only for so many years. And so now they're reviewing to see whether, I believe this is what's going on, is to see whether or not the little playground that they have at Sycamore Commons, which kids aren't allowed to ride their tricycles to,
that's all for their
is enough of a park to satisfy the needs of the people that live there.
Uh-huh. And so that's going to be discussed. And all you people should bring your tricycles to the city council, perhaps?
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
Have a tricycle in, so to speak.
Right.
So it's Mercy Charities Housing does not allow tricycle riding on the grounds?
Well, that's my understanding. Well,
maybe they're trying to weed out those who are, shall we say, insufficiently mature to understand their responsibilities.
That could be.
Yeah. Yeah, Mercy Charities, that was another of the concerns of the tenants of the Lee and the Dolphin, that they had numerous rules at their other projects, Neary Lagoon and Sycamore Commons, that seemed to be unduly restrictive and also kind of violated the culture of, would not seem to fit in well with the culture of people in the Latino community.
Well, it also seems to not really fit in too well with raising children, you know? I mean, if your kid can't ride a tricycle down the sidewalk, it seems to be really problematic right there.
It's good discipline. It's like sort of, toilet training, I think.
Yeah, but, I mean...
Ride your tricycle in the tricycle riding areas.
There you
I
go.
Don't think there's a private apartment complex in town that has such restrictive rules.
Well, they also have other restrictions about posters not being allowed except at election time, and a series of different things about even the colors of what you can put in the windows not being, you know, being limited. And it's there was a, at least at the Sycamore Commons, we actually never got into that in great detail when we talked about the criticism of the Dolphin Lee project, because the whole idea of spending $12.5 million on relocation that wouldn't relocate everybody, and on building housing that wouldn't house the, even as many people who are there now, seemed so preposterous that we had to focus on that.
Right.
You know, and we didn't really get into all this other stuff, but it's, I guess, going to come up as Mercy Charities Housing, given $1.5 million by the city council in a Halloween trick-or-treat deal. And it's
yeah,
you know,
I forgot to bring my trick-or-treat bag with me that afternoon.
Well, Mercy didn't, and nor did the redevelopment agency. They were there, you know, and they even had their masks on, although it's hard to tell the masks from the faces sometimes.
Right.
So anyway, getting on with the city council meeting coming up on the 14th of November, there is also a notice of completion of the asbestos abatement project at City Hall. And I guess in a way, this is the asbestos, we're talking about the, is this the area that used to be the old police station they're talking about?
Right, yes.
It's right next to City Hall. It's part of the City Hall building.
And the council offices will be moving over there.
One wonders why the homeless shelter isn't moving over there, since it's downtown. There's restroom facilities there, centrally located. You know, there's space, and but of course, I think that typewriters in this case, or I should say computers, need, you know, need housing space at night, particularly when everything is locked up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's happening. That's item 20 on the consent agenda in the afternoon, 3 o'clock city council meeting. Then 23 is the public hearing on the proposed use of local law enforcement block grant funds and the acceptance of California law enforcement technology equipment. Again, I realize you're not in touch with the actual documentation of the staff report and the, any other documents. This, however, talks about amending the 2000-2001 budget in the amount of $180,000 to accept the funds granted by the state of California. What's wrong with accepting money for the police department? I mean, isn't that sort of a no-lose situation?
Well, usually, I mean, in order for them to accept these funds, the amendment to the budget is that they have to match it.
Really?
Or usually, you know, even if it's not a 50-50 match, sometimes the city only has to match 10% or 30% or whatever. But, you know, it's more money coming out of our budget for the police. And, you know, the police already take up over a third of the budget money. And to just keep on dumping money, you know, I mean, it's like, I believe you asked for some information about, you know, how many people are stopped that are white, how many people are stopped that are brown, and the police decided, well, we don't have the technology, we don't have the software in our computers to be able to do this.
No, they actually, what they actually said was that they wouldn't have the software for a while, but they were hoping to have it by next summer.
Right, so this might be, you know, where they're getting this software from.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, 10 years ago, before the computer permeated every aspect of human existence, people could actually get information like that by looking at reports and making tabulations by hand. And it seems like this is a real ridiculous thing. Oh, I have to take a moment, Robert.
Okay. We're talking to Scott Graham here, who is probably in the hospital schmoozing the local nurses, who I can't quite, not quite clear what he's up to.
Who?
You.
Oh, I had to talk to a nurse for a moment.
There you are. You see, I was right on target. So you were talking about item 23, and why can't, you know, we use manual records? They were apparently good enough for the last 500 years. Why can't we use them still? And I agree with that. And people who are interested in that issue can also bring it to the Citizens Police Review Board, which meets tomorrow at 5:30 at City Hall. We're talking about the City Council meeting, which meets the day after, where you can also bring up this issue. But the Citizens Police Review Board, or the Citizens Police Rubber Stamping Board, as I capriciously call it, is supposed to be involved in really monitoring these things from a citizen's point of view, from those of us who are wondering where's our money going? You know, how are police actually treating people? You know, how can we be sure that we aren't having racial profiling or homeless profiling, as Flower Hopkins here was talking about earlier? And people can come at 5:30. I note, by the way, that there's nothing on the Citizens Police Review Board agenda on this issue. It was on the agenda last time, only to be kicked ahead several months by Arnie Leff, the chair of the Citizens Police Review Board, who has been doing this with almost every significant issue that has come up throughout his tenure. It's just amazing. I mean, I think, who knows? I mean, some would say it's because he was appointed by Councilmember Tim Fitzmaurice, who isn't terribly excited about police reform. Some would say because Leff is a practical politician who believes there can be no action taken until City Council has a strong activist majority, which I suppose it still doesn't have after the elections, and I'm going to ask you to comment on that a little further. But anyway, the CPRB meeting is happening, and you can also talk about the police, as I said, on items 15 and 23 in the afternoon agenda. The next item on the agenda is the Poganip Clubhouse Rehabilitation Plan, which will give an $18,500 to fund immediate repairs of the Poganip Clubhouse. Now, this is no doubt a program for family shelter, perhaps, or for women's escaping violence. Is that right?
I don't believe so, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
I believe what the grand plan is for the Poganip Clubhouse is that they're going to restore this building so that they can then rent it out to people for private parties, you know, weddings.
Well, Scott Kennedy would certainly justify this by saying it gives more money to the social service programs, right?
No. How is it doing that? It won't even pay for itself.
So this is so what's the point of I'm interested because they're going to spend money renovating the Poganip Clubhouse, but they couldn't even put the money into a survey to find out if the Rex Court apartments in the Beach Flats, 15 units for 15 families, could be renovated before they decided to tear them down.
Right. Well, let's see, they already spent, I don't know what it was, $70,000 investigating whether the Poganip Clubhouse could be fixed.
And they found out that it could.
Yeah, and so this money that they're spending now is just to make emergency repairs to shore the building up so that it doesn't deteriorate further before they vote to spend $1 million or whatever it's going to cost to fix this place.
So you don't think this is a good investment of money?
No, I think it's ridiculous.
I see.
Because if they redo the place, then they're going to have to make the road better going out to it so people can actually use it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're going to have parking out there. The whole thing is, this is the green belt. There's not supposed to be parking. You're not supposed to be driving cars out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is just another thing of where the voters voted to do something, to buy this property as permanent green belt property, and now the council's taking it upon themselves to turn it back into a country club for the elite here in town.
So, if people want to talk on this item, that's item 25 on the afternoon agenda. Item 27 is homeless services supplemental funding, $50,000 for additional winter shelter funding, which sounds good. Social service program contract with the Homeless Community Resource Center, one-time funding for equipment and such for armory snacks for the homeless garden project, and public trust fund money to CDBG funds. This is a series of $50,000 to go to homeless services supplemental funding, but I doubt it's going to be allowing for significant expansion of the winter shelter, which is really the key question now.
Right.
So that's on 20. Anything you want to say about item 27?
Well, the whole thing about the homeless garden takes us back to Poganip. Supposedly, Poganip is where the homeless garden is going to eventually end up with a permanent site. Instead of moving forward with this, they've been spending their money on the clubhouse in Poganip. Instead of spending their money doing the environmental review that will be necessary in order to move the homeless garden into Poganip.
Interesting.
So the homeless garden is in a big stall.
And the homeless...
And they're rushing forward with this clubhouse renovation.
And the homeless garden was evicted by Kennedy and Rotkin and the old city council for, so that the Pelton Street, I call them the Pelton Street palaces, monster homes could be put in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the... And the same people who were vehemently opposing this, like Christopher Crone, has he done anything to put on the agenda or to bring up the fact that this money is being spent for the Poganip Clubhouse instead of for environmental reviews to get the garden project transferred up to the Poganip?
I don't know. We'll have to see what he says when we bring it up.
But in the last 2 years, I take it, I haven't heard much of this.
I haven't heard say anything then bad about Poganip Clubhouse at all.
Item 28 is the communications from council members, which is a joining the petition to the District Court of Appeals to order a judge to accept amicus briefs in the Mumia Abu Jamal case to grant, as well as grant an evidentiary hearing. This is Rotkin's resolution. Again, it's an attempt, I guess, to ensure justice for Mumia Abu Jamal.
Right.
And we need to be nice if we got some justice for some local people in our own jails. Rotkin and others seem to be very enthusiastic about doing this when the case is not so close at home. But I mean, I approve of what he's doing here. But
right.
I
that's a typical move on their part, you know.
Yeah.
I also approve of what's going on in this case, but as far as, you know, wanting a full disclosure of what happened here with Mumia, but, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, the city council can be right on about various issues, you know, civil rights issues, police issues, all that kind of stuff, as long as it's not here in Santa Cruz. If the exact same thing was here in Santa Cruz, they would either be silent about it or they would be on the other side of the issue.
I'm afraid that that's, I would think that likely too. That's the afternoon city council meeting. They then have the 5 o'clock oral communication session of the Redevelopment Agency, and I want to kind of quickly point out that there is on every agenda a statement that the Redevelopment Agency, which is the group that does all the housing stuff, the Redevelopment Agency is supposed to meet at 5 o'clock or when the afternoon session ends, whichever happens first. However, they haven't been doing that, and they've been doing that to the detriment of people who want to testify in these sessions and understand what's going on. Which conceivably could be considered what we call a Brown Act violation, a violation of the Open Meetings Act, which requires letting the public know when and where things are happening.
Right.
And giving them adequate documentation. There's an item on the Redevelopment Agency agenda at 5 o'clock. First of all, you can come and talk during the oral communications period about, again, the sellout of the Dolphin Lee tenants, for those who want to do that. Then the item coming up is... Again, it's a repeat of this item about the Sycamore Commons Cooperative Housing Project Park Extension, which you already talked about.
Right. This fees that they are supposed to pay in order to...
Maybe this is essentially another giveaway for Mercy Charities Housing is my concern.
Right, yeah. I believe that's exactly what it is. It's okay... You know, you're supposed to pay this fee, but we're not going to make you.
And the third thing on the redevelopment agenda, item number 3, is a loan agreement with the Downtown Association to fund the installation of downtown tree lights at a cost of $38,000. Any comment on this?
Well, it seems a little excessive. I think you could go, you know, any individual could go to Costco and for maybe, you know, anywhere from $200 to $400, buy enough tree lights to do every tree on Pacific Avenue, and then, you know, okay, well, there's $400. So you're telling me it's going to cost $36,000 to put them up?
I mean, that does sound insane. A little up there, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
maybe we should volunteer to put them up for half as much or a tenth as much.
Yeah, or we could get homeless people to put them up for twice as much.
There you go. That would be even better, actually.
Yeah.
The money would go to some useful purpose.
Right.
Then there's an adjournment, and the 7 o'clock evening session, which is the session most people associate with City Council because it's where you actually have the official oral communications at 7 to 7.30 or thereabouts.
Well, plus most people are home and able to watch it on TV or actually attend the meeting. The daytime meeting is usually not well attended and probably not that many viewers
right.
in the television audience.
Exactly so. We saw that phenomenon in the strange noon Halloween meeting where they gave $1.5 million to Mercy Charities to buy a piece of property that it will then own.
Right.
In perpetuity, I guess they're claiming that there'll be low-income housing there for the smaller number of people than currently reside there. in perpetuity. It's a strange agreement and a strange Election Eve agreement. Anyway, the oral communications I wanted to just sort of comment on and get you to comment on, Scott. We're talking to Scott Graham here on Free Radio Santa Cruz by phone from his hospital bed after having been beaten soundly by Keith Sugar and Scott Kennedy in conjunction. No, just kidding. Sugar and Kennedy, actually, you're on pretty good terms with those guys, right? Sorry?
Yeah, we were all together in the womb at one point.
Indeed. The oral communications period has been the subject of some controversy because that's really one of the few places the public is allowed to raise issues that, say, the city council won't put on the agenda and that are not being addressed. And they, because of essentially homeless pressure in the late 80s, Marty Wormout, then mayor, now supervisor, along with John Laird and Rotkin, devised plans to, they cut back oral communications. Originally, I think that was a 45-minute period. Originally, you could speak as long as you wanted to, provided the time was not, you know, you divided the time fairly and so forth. This was changed to a mandatory 3-minute limit, half an hour period.
Right.
And the current city council, which is about to go out, came in under the promise, three of them anyway, that they were going to work on more meaningful
public input.
Exactly. And we see
they don't not only allow more public input, but they would actually listen to the public input.
Well, yeah, you can't have everything, you know.
Right.
They also, you know, so they've been engaging in various tricks and traps, such as they have been using a blacklist on occasion. Sugar has not allowed people to speak, not just because they spoke at the previous meeting, but you're allowed to speak provided there's time. But he actually blacklisted people from speaking. He created situations where people who he interrupted, and he's done this frequently at the mic, let's say myself, he told me I couldn't speak at the next, I couldn't even attend the next council meeting. And of course, I was allowed anyway. So we got strange, contradictory messages. He has had people arrested and literally 5150'd away from council meetings, such as David Silva.
Right.
He has had an individuals targeted before the meeting, such as James Ney, who were part of a homeless protest, held outside for an hour and a half, then released. He's got his own way of proceeding, which I became so alarmed with that I filed Brown Act